Cooper comes up, hits it. Yes!
It's astonishing! It's Lee Griffiths!
Bogleach. There's the ball!
Cuthbert, she straights. Goal! Aaron Cuthbert!
Oh, what a goal! What a goal! What a goal by Mick Fergan!
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Official Scotland Podcast. We're here once again at Hampden Park in the museum, and today we're joined by none other than the Scotland manager, Steve Clark. Steve, thanks for joining us. How are you?
No problem.
You well?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Been out and about watching a few games and looking forward to the doubleheader coming up.
3 months in the job. Time flies. What's it been like over that period?
Different. Obviously, for somebody who's used to working day-to-day with players, there's been a lot of downtime, which was good at the start because obviously I had a difficult or a long season last season, and then the international games were tacked on at the end of that. So I needed my holiday. I had 4 weeks where I just switched off completely. It was great. And then middle of July I started thinking I should be doing something, I should be working. Everybody's going back pre-season. So that was different, not being involved in a group for a pre-season training. But once the matches started in August, out and about, watching games, meeting people, it's been interesting, a totally different job.
Like you say, you come off the back of a long, hard season, but you then go straight into the Scotland job. So how did you go about picking that first squad and sort of flipping over to that mindset?
No, it was a difficult change to come out for the club football. Obviously, at the end of the season, there was a number of different issues about getting players to come and join the squad. We managed to put together, I thought, a really good squad of players. They all turned up. They all really enthusiastic. Was good to work with them for the 10 days that we were together, and hopefully I'll get most of them back in the coming weeks or the coming days for the upcoming matches.
In terms of the staff that joined you for the last game, the likes of Alex Dyer, Stephen Reid, Stevie Woods, are those going to be permanent fixtures, or can we expect other faces to rotate in or out?
Well, those three will be with me again for the next matches. They didn't do anything wrong in the June camp, so they deserve to come back. I think familiarity as well is also good around the place. The squad of players that we had at the end of last season seemed to work well with the coaching staff that I appointed. So I don't see any reason to change that at the moment. Further down the line, you never know what's going to happen. In football, things can happen very quickly and you have to adjust and make changes, but at the moment there's no need to make any changes.
You and the staff only had a very short time with the players before the games. What sort of things do you work on then in that short period, because I guess you have to prioritise?
Yeah, it was a short period, but believe it or not, it's a little bit longer than what I'm going to have this time, because obviously you've got players that are playing next weekend on the Sunday, so the Monday will be a recovery day, and then you have a couple of training sessions Tuesday, Wednesday. Get yourself ready for the game on Friday. You know, so you're only going to have maximum 5 training sessions to get the team in shape. So the June camp was actually good because we had a little bit longer. Managed to put down only a few basic principles. Hopefully, you saw some of that on the pitch in the two games against Cyprus and Belgium. And we just tried to continue what we started to build then.
Like you're saying, time might dictate some of this, but did you learn anything from the first get-together which you would maybe then implement, change the structure for this one coming up?
No, I think you look at, obviously I've been away, I've looked at both games since. The Cyprus game here, I thought we acquitted ourselves well. We went to sleep on a corner. It could have cost us 2 points, but we reacted really well and got the late goal to win it, which was great because it was a game that we had to win. No getting away from that fact. The Belgium game is a disappointing result because eventually you look at the game and you lose 3-0, looks like a bit of a hammering, but as always in football, there were moments within that game where we were really competitive and the game could have changed on some moments. It didn't, we lost it, but I think there were some good signs in that game for me.
On a personal note, how did it feel to manage the Scotland team for the first time? If you go back to that Cyprus game, I'm sure you're very much focused on the job in hand. Did you get the chance to take it all in and reflect and see how it felt for you?
It was nice to walk out there as manager of your country. I said when I was appointed that it's the pinnacle of my career. It's a great honour, and hopefully I don't let anybody down, and we can get the results that they require to get us to a major tournament. That's the bottom line. So yeah, it was nice, it was enjoyable, but once the game starts, you're in game mode, and thankfully we managed to, like I say, get the late goal and the win that we needed to keep the campaign alive.
Do you try and treat that then like any other game? Because it's obviously a big moment, but does that come with, you know, the big motivational speech before the game? Do you say anything in particular to the players on a match day like that?
Not really. I don't think you should need to motivate players to play for their country, and certainly the group of players that we had didn't need any motivating. They understood that the Cyprus game was a must win. I thought they handled the pressure of the game pretty well and got the result that we needed. So no big motivational speeches required.
You mentioned falling asleep at the corner for the goal. Did you feel the worst at that point? Or was there always the belief that you could get back in front?
I'm an eternal optimist when I'm standing on the sideline. You always think you've got a chance. It was unfortunate we lost the goal. We discussed it afterwards, and something that hopefully won't happen again on that type of situation. But you never know. It's football. It's one of these things. But now we adjusted well. I thought the team picked up the challenge and got in about Cyprus, and like I said, we managed to get the winner, which was good for us.
Yeah, Ollie Burke pops up with the winner. What was the message to the players after the game? Is there anything in particular you tried to get across?
No, just well done. I think sometimes straight after a game you can overanalyze it a little bit. You can say too much. I'm not really one for speaking too much after a game. I prefer to let things calm down a little bit and then, well, with a more reasoned voice, talk about what happened or what didn't happen or what should have happened, and I think players appreciate that.
Give us an insight into what the process is like then for you and the staff. Is there a debrief after it where you all go through it? Do you give yourself a bit of time?
Between the two games is a short period of time, so we did a lot of work in the build-up to Cyprus. That was out the double header. The main focus was on the Cyprus game to make sure we got the win. We got that. But then immediately you're thinking about travelling to Belgium. You're patching up your squad. You're looking at one or two little knocks and niggles. Obviously, we lost Ryan Fraser. Wasn't fit to start the next game. Andy Robertson had to pull out the next game. So you're then immediately into the next game mode. So you don't have that much time to debrief on the Cyprus game and those two days between the matches. So it was more a case of getting ready for Belgium and trying to get a team on the pitch that would be competitive, and I think we managed to do that.
I mean, you mentioned the moments within the Belgium game that you were pleased with. Is that then just a sign of how good they are and what you're up against at that level?
Well, they're ranked number one in the world at the moment, so that's pretty good. I don't think they're going to go much higher than that. So, no, like I say, there was moments in the game at 0-0 on 44, 45 minutes. You're thinking you're going to get to half-time 0-0. You can regroup, refresh. And it makes the second half more difficult for Belgium because they have to start again at level and try and break you down. But we switched off just on half-time. To be fair, it was a fantastic delivery from Hazard. Probably most other players in the world would have let that ball run out for a corner and try to score off the corner. But he got there, put in a great cross for Lukaku to score. And that made it more difficult. The second goal sort of took the game away from us. But then we had a big moment with a counter-attack where Scott McKenna was unlucky not to score. Really unlucky. James Forrest couldn't get the ball out of his feet for the rebound. And if it goes 2-1 with 10, 12 minutes to go, you're right in the game. So, like I said before, there were moments in the game. And I thought the team shape was good. The boys worked ever so hard to try and stop a very, very good Belgian team.
It's two very different challenges. A home game that you're expected to win and a away game that's, you know, you're a massive underdog. How do you reflect on the double header as a whole then, looking back on it?
Yeah, probably because I know that we needed to get something from the Belgian game, I'm a little bit disappointed. If we could have got 4 points out of those two games, it would have been great. We've got three. We're still competitive in the group and two massive home matches coming up.
And now it's back to picking another squad. How do you assess the strength you've got across, well, not only this country, but other countries as well? How satisfied are you with the group you've got to choose from?
Now, the group is good. I think I have a lot of good players to select from. Obviously, at this stage of the season, some players not playing, some injuries. Just been sitting upstairs trying to go through a big list of players and narrow it down to a squad selection. We're getting close to that now. So hopefully I make the right choices. But there will be one or two players that are absent. You look for a little bit of continuity in certain positions in the team, certain selections. Maybe that that's not going to happen this time, but I'm sure the squad that we put together will be very competitive in the two games.
How encouraging is it to, you know, we've seen the English Premier League return, you've got players at Liverpool and Man United, and perhaps once Kieran Tierney's fit at Arsenal, how encouraging is it to see them operating at that level?
I think it's great. It's great for the boys individually, and it's great for Scottish football. The one concern I would have is that hopefully they all play in the English Premier League. And it's also a case with people like John McGinn, Kenny McLean, who've just got promotion to that league. Ollie as well, they've just arrived in the Premier League, so they're not immediately going to be top English Premier League players. They're going to have to take time and adjust to the level, play games at that level. But I'm sure that all the boys that are involved in the English Premier League, if they're still involved this time next year, they'll be much better players for the experience.
And I think you'll now be the third Scotland manager who has to sit and answer questions about how you fit in Kieran Tierney and Andy Robertson. Is it something you've given much thought to yet?
Not really, because obviously I knew that Kieran was going to be injured for this camp coming up. He's not quite fully fit yet. He's working hard on his fitness. When I've got them both together, it'll be a fantastic problem to have. Two great players, and I'm sure we'll find a way to get them both in the team and helping the country.
You mentioned that now the season's up and running, you've been getting out and about to games. Is there a particular structure to how you do it? Is it just identifying
as many Scottish players as possible within it?
It's just getting to as many matches as you can. Obviously, there are some players who would be definite picks, so maybe you don't have to watch them quite as much as other players who are maybe picks. You know, you're looking at all these players, and you want to make sure that you pick the right ones. You also want to see them play for their club, to see how they play, to see how the club managers use them on the pitch. There's no point in having a player that's an attacking midfield player and then he comes to us and I'm asking him to do a defensive role. You have to try and find out what they're doing at their club that gets them selected to play for their club, and then try and fit them into a framework that suits the national team.
On that then, is it the same as, say, when you were a club manager, you would go and watch a player perhaps with a view to bringing him in? Is it the same, or are there differences there because you've got that structure that they're trying to fit within?
The pieces together and getting a good team on the pitch.
So many players across so many leagues and divisions. How do you keep a track of them all? Are you a spreadsheet man? Are you old school with the pen and paper, or good memory?
I try and keep up here. I use my laptop a little bit. I have got an extended list of players that we keep an eye on. You've got possible selections, probable selections, and ones to keep an eye on for the future. So We try and cover as many we can. Obviously, we've got a scouting department here as well who go out and watch matches and put reports in. I've got my own team working, so Stephen Reid will go and watch games. Obviously, Alex Dyer's working in Scottish football, so seeing different players every week. And one or two other scouts that I send out just to keep an eye on things.
And nowadays, of course, we've got the likes of Johnny Russell playing in the MLS, Liam Henderson playing in Serie A, just different, perhaps a different challenge. How do you keep track on those types?
Well, all the scouts keep asking me if they can go to New York to watch. To watch the games over there. Listen, it's very difficult to keep a track of the boys that are playing in America, because obviously it's a long way away and it's difficult to get there. But there's so many games now on video that you can catch up and keep an eye on the players. The ones in Italy and Spain are maybe a little bit closer to home that we can at some stage get out to watch and hopefully they can be part of what we're trying to do in the future.
What level of communication have you had with the likes of Scott Gemmell to look at players already, you know, within the system who might be able to come up from the 21s and benefit your squad?
Yeah, I've had one or two little brief chats with Scott. Believe it or not, we've actually kept missing each other. He was up in Scotland last week doing his squad announcement. I sent him a text saying that it would be nice to meet up in the Midlands somewhere. He said, "No, I'm in Scotland, but we'll meet up next week." And I'm saying, "Well, I'm in Scotland next week," and he's back in the Midlands. So we've missed each other a little bit, but it's only a phone call and a chat about it. I think it's important for the under 21 group to work with Scott and try to improve and get used to playing international football. And then when they do step up, when they're ready to step up, I'm sure we won't make too many mistakes.
There have been a number of players for different reasons who previously were involved but maybe haven't been recently. Have you had discussions with any of them, perhaps with a view to returning?
Yeah, over the summer, trying to keep in touch with some of them with varying degrees of success. Listen, players get to a certain stage of their career and with the financial rewards that are out there, for especially the boys playing in the English leagues, if they feel that by not coming and playing for their country they can extend their club careers, you have to respect that. And if they've given their best for the country over the number of times that they've been picked, then you have to respect their decision and move on. There's always a place for someone else.
The thing is now as well, there's also a lot of players who are eligible for Scotland but maybe haven't played for Scotland before. I don't know if we're allowed to mention any names, but like the son of a goalkeeper, for instance, that you used to play alongside. Are these types of guys in your thought? Is it about just monitoring them or having specific conversations?
Again, it's just to have conversations and find out where they're at. The one you're talking about is playing in the English Premier League week in, week out. He feels as though he's got a chance to get called up to the English national team and wants to keep his options open. He's a fine goalkeeper at the moment. This moment in time, he's not available for selection with Scotland. So we look at the goalkeepers we have got, and it's always better to concentrate on the players that are available to play for us. But we certainly keep looking, and hopefully we can get one or two more to help us in the future.
I think it goes without saying, winning games, getting to tournaments, that's the priority. But within that, is there a particular style that you would like to impose on this team?
No, just a winning style. I'm not so precious as a coach or a manager that I think they have to play in a certain way. You have to play maybe different ways against different opponents. You have to find ways to win matches. And I think that's the biggest thing for any team, is you have to find a way that you're comfortable playing, that you know will get you results, and something you believe in. If you believe in the way you're playing and you've got good players and they work hard, then quite often you'll get the right results. And that's what we'll try and do. We'll try and give the squad, the team, a winning mentality, and if we can get that, then obviously you're winning matches, you're going to qualify for major tournaments. That's what we want to do.
Is that the main thing then that you're trying to get across to the staff and the players? Is it a mentality? Any other sort of philosophies you're trying to impose on them?
No, I think you're just looking at the mentality. There's, like I said before, you get very, very few training sessions to work with the players, so you can't baffle them with tactics and try to change the way that they play with their club. The best way is to try and fit everybody in that plays, so they can play in a similar way to how they play for their clubs, and then try and install that winning mentality that probably try and help to teach them how to win matches at international level. And if they can do that, then everyone will be happy.
Because the day-to-day job role is obviously very different, but is that the one thing that you can implement that's the same as what you try to implement with your club sides?
The mentality. I think the mentality... The psychological, the mental aspect is key. You know, if you go into a match and you believe you can win it, then you've got a better chance of winning it. If you go into a match thinking it's going to be really difficult, this is too much for us, then it's harder to win the game. So, yeah, try and get a positive mentality and, like I said, a winning mentality.
On a personal note for you, you obviously had a very successful career as a coach or a number two. Was it always the ambition, though, to be the main man, so to speak?
I'm not really sure. These things just happen, you know. Your career, obviously, had a good career as a player. At the end of that, you start to think what you're going to do as you stop. I got an opportunity to move into coaching very quickly with Ruud Gullit at Newcastle. It meant that I had to probably stop playing a year or 2 years before I wanted to. But I made that decision then. I thought, nah, why not? If I enjoy football, I enjoy being in the world of football, I wanted to stay in the game. And that was a chance to become a coach, so I became a coach. I enjoyed coaching. Eventually, you hope that somebody will offer you the chance to be a manager. I got that with West Bromwich Albion, and I enjoyed it. And I thought I'd try it a few more times. And obviously, it went quite well at some clubs, not so well at other clubs. And I found myself sitting here now as manager of the national team. So somewhere along the line, I must have done something right.
What was that first transition between assistant to head coach like?
Enjoyable. I think when I did it, I was quite late. I mean, I spent a few years at Chelsea as assistant manager to various managers. Enjoyed the experience, got myself in a position where I was really comfortable working with players. And then decided that I'd leave Chelsea, go out there and try and take myself out of my comfort zone, if you like. You know, Chelsea, I could have stayed there forever. But I wanted to get out and about. I made a little sideways move, but the first one was I joined Gianfranco Zola at West Ham, was just to take myself out of my comfort zone to work with different players, see if, I mean, obviously I knew I could coach the players at Chelsea because they were familiar with me, I was familiar with them. You go out, you put yourself under pressure to work with different players. And that's what happens, you go from job to job after that. Different people working with different players, and obviously I end up sitting here as the national manager, and I feel I'm in a good place to work with different players now. It doesn't faze me. I don't worry about big egos or big personalities. I've handled that before. I've handled that through my career, and I look forward to working with the players here in Scotland.
What was the biggest thing you learned then from the West Brom experience? If that the first managerial role, what's the biggest lesson you learned?
Don't lose 4 games in a row because you get the sack. and that was the first time in 18 months that we'd actually had such a bad run. It cost me my job. So, no, that's the one. Try and pick up points and don't allow the matches to run away from you.
Plenty of success before that, of course. And you almost ended Jose Mourinho's home record, a man who you knew well. What's the relationship?
Yeah, it was actually Stephen Reid that gave away that penalty.
Do you remind him of it often?
Last minute. No, Stephen reminds me all the time. He was incandescent with rage because he was convinced it wasn't a penalty, as we all were. But listen, it's part of football, it's what happens.
He's obviously a massive name. What's the relationship been like with Jose over the years?
No, the time we worked together was great. We kept in touch periodically for a number of years after that. But gradually in football, you sort of drift away. Jose's got his own life, he's got his own jobs to do. I was concentrating on my job, so maybe not in touch as much now, but I'm sure friends forever.
Would you be able to pick one manager as the one that you learned the most from as your during your time as a coach?
No, I'm always... I think it's a question that everybody always asks, but you take bits and pieces from everybody you've worked with. Obviously, the better ones you take more from, and the not-so-good ones, you maybe take a little bit less, but everybody's got something to teach you, and if you're open-minded, you can learn from everybody. So I've always tried to be open-minded.
When you look at the different successes, and there have been a few of them, you take Kilmarnock into Europe. We mentioned that, you know, West Brom, extremely high English Premier League finish for a club at that time, at Reading to the FA Cup run as well. Are you able to sort of compare them and pick what's the best achievement, so to speak?
Not really. I'm quite good at just moving on. You know, we had a good season at West Brom. We finished their highest ever Premier League position. I think that still stands now. So that shows that it was a difficult thing to do. But I had a great group of players at West Brom, and they did great for me. It was the same at Reading when we had the cup run. It was a great cup run. Everyone enjoyed it. It didn't work out for us in the league, and I lost my job there. You move on, you go to the next one. Come on, it was good. We worked well together, me and the players and the staff, and we achieved a level of success. We didn't win any trophies, but we probably won the league outside the Old Firm. You know, Celtic and Rangers are pretty much nailed on for the top 2 spots in Scotland. So to finish best of the rest was a good achievement. And obviously, I must have caught somebody's eye because I've turned up here now.
Now, you were here as a player, of course, 6 Scotland caps. How do you reflect on that time? What are your memories of playing for Scotland?
Only ever say about the Scotland caps is I always say only 6.
Should have been more.
Because I felt the career that I had, I should maybe got a few more caps. But like I said before, I'm not somebody to live in the past. I worry about it. It was what it was. The managers at the time chose not to pick me. You've got to respect their decisions. And it was good. I enjoyed playing for my country. Although I've lived a long time in England, and a lot of people, my family especially, tell me I'm very Anglified, but I'm actually passionate and proud to be a Scotsman. So it's nice when you get capped for your country, and obviously it's it's nice to be the manager of your country as well.
I think you only lost one game out of six. That's not a bad record. How does the...
Yeah, it was the last one.
how does the feeling contrast then between, you know, the first time you walk out as a player and you stand there, and then when you're the man who has all the responsibility of being the manager?
It's two totally different things. As a player, you concentrate much more on yourself. As a manager, you're thinking about everything. You know, you're not just going out there and thinking, oh, this is great, I'm the manager of Scotland. You're thinking about how the opposition are going to start the game, how they might line up, how your players are. So your mind's all over the place. As a manager, you're thinking about so many things. As a player, you're just going out there concentrated on one thing, and that's to have a good game.
In what ways has international football changed from when you were a player to now?
No, I think football evolves all the time. The game gets quicker, faster, stronger, much more tactically aware now. Different tactics, different systems. The game used to be a little bit more hustle and bustle and probably a little bit more direct. Now you've got the passing game, the statistics. You've got so many different things. The sports science, everything's improved over the years. Football's evolving all the time. So the game now, the international game now, is completely different to the international game when I was a player. But football has also evolved, even from when I played with Chelsea at the start of the English Premier League. It's unrecognisable now, the league now, to how it was then. So everything changing all the time and evolving. So I think the fact that I'm still involved in the game after such a long time means that I've managed to evolve as well, which is good.
Back to the present day, big doubleheader coming up. What are your thoughts going into that one?
Yeah, two good games, two great games. We're going to need the Tartan Army. We're going to need good support. The boys are going to need a lot of help from the sidelines, a good atmosphere here at Hampden. And hopefully we can get the points that keep us competitive in the group.
Is that another aim for you? Because that was something that perhaps capped off your time at Kilmarnock, the way you were able to fill Rugby Park. There are a number of Scotland fans who perhaps have drifted away for different reasons. Is that something you're keen to do? Would you have a message for those that you're trying to bring back?
Yeah, I think it's something that we have to try and do. But it's not so much about just putting out a message and saying, please come back and support us. The players have to go on the pitch. They have to show that they can compete with these top teams. You know, Russia were last eight in the World Cup. Belgium were last four. A lot of people would tell you that Belgium were the best team in the last World Cup. They're number one in the world. So if we can go out and we can show that we can compete with these teams and get points off them, the supporters will come back. Supporters like to be associated with success, and the Scottish national team has had a long period of time where they haven't qualified for a major tournament. So if we start to show that we have a chance to qualify for a major tournament, the Tartan Army will come out and support us. I was amazed with the supporters in Belgium. I actually said to Alex Dyer as we were going over, I said, look at these supporters. We just lost this game 3-0. And they gave the team a fantastic ovation at the end of the game. I think because they appreciated what they saw on the pitch, the players' effort. They knew that the players had put everything into that game. And it's great to see. And we know within the camp that if we are successful and committed, the Tartan Army will be there in full force.
Well, Stevie, we wish you well. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much.
And that brings us to a close on the latest edition of the Official Scotland Podcast. Thanks for listening, and please do subscribe to the previous episodes on your usual podcast platforms.